using old drugs to fight a new disease.
Everything we're doing is in the realm of experimental.
The coronavirus is crossing borders, and travel bans are not a long-term strategy. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Russian election interference could be worse this time around.
We are now operating almost blind in terms of being able to tell what the Russians are actually doing.
And a mom is making kids proud of their Iranian heritage.
As a parent, I felt that I failed to introduce the Persian culture to my kids.
One children's book at a time.
I wanted them to be in stories, to feel what Iran had been once upon a time.
And on a Friday, gin that does more than just make you tipsy. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you can make it today. The epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak is China, but today officials in South Korea, Iran, and Ukraine are trying to manage concerns about the illness spreading. There are actually no cases in Ukraine, but fear and misinformation caused protesters in a Ukrainian town to attack buses carrying people who'd just been evacuated from Wuhan, China. Those buses were heading to a quarantine center. The Ukrainian president and health minister are trying to quell fear. At the World Health Organization in Geneva today, the director repeated that the window of opportunity to contain the virus is narrowing. Here's Tedros Ghebreyesus.
This outbreak could go any direction. It could even be messy. What I'm saying is it's in our hands now.
So what is being done to stop the coronavirus from becoming a global pandemic? We reached out to one of America's top scientists working on the problem. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's also on the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Fauci wants answers to at least two questions. Are there more cases out there that we don't know about? And can people who have no symptoms transmit the virus? Fauci thinks the WHO delegation in China might be able to help answer those questions.
Well, the delegation is there. It's a multinational delegation, and hopefully they will accomplish the goal of both assisting the Chinese in their attempts to contain this, as well as to gain important information that would inform our own policies and our own strategy.
So you had mentioned earlier this month that you were hopeful that the WHO delegation would include U.S. scientists. Is that the case, and why would that be valuable?
Well, I mean, obviously, for example, our own CDC, our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, have some of the best epidemiologists in the world. Here at the NIH, we do the fundamental, basic, and clinical research to develop countermeasures in the form of diagnostics, therapeutics, and vaccines. And so all of those things together, a combination of understanding the evolution of the outbreak in China, which obviously is the epicenter of what's going on, as well as to understand what the demands and needs are going to be with regard to countermeasures. It's always important and, I think, contributory to have people on the ground there. And that's the reason why we were pleased to see that the WHO delegation will include individuals from our groups.
You said that they will be there. So does that mean that the CDC is currently there with the WHO delegation?
They are. They are there. See, the issue, the reason why there's some hesitancy when people ask questions about the details are that, I mean, obviously the Chinese are very sensitive about information getting out before they give it. So we know what's going on. We are satisfied that we have the representation there, but the details of it, we would prefer to leave to the Chinese when they are asked, as opposed to our getting ahead of them. And that's the reason why when you ask direct questions about the details of the delegation, there's always some hesitancy because we want to be respectful of the Chinese.
China has dozens of trials underway to test treatments, more than 80, I gather. What seems most promising, and have you been involved?
Yes. I mean, obviously, we're in communication with our colleagues in China, and we're doing similar things like right here in the United States. For example, there are a number of compounds, usually drugs that have been developed for other virus infections that are being repurposed to determine if they work in the coronavirus infection. One of them is called remdesivir, which has been developed for other viral infections. It showed in the test tube and in an animal model to have some activity against coronaviruses, particularly the SARS virus. So now the Chinese are doing a randomized controlled trial in China looking at the effect of remdesivir compared to the standard of care alone without remdesivir. Parallel to this, as you may know, we air evacuated several people from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in Yokohama Harbor in Japan. We brought them back to the United States and brought them to one of our containment hospitals in Omaha, Nebraska. They're there now, and we're going to institute this protocol for this drug, remdesivir, among those individuals. In fact, I think we believe that we started it just last night. So hopefully we'll get some good information from that.
I know you've been closely involved with the treatment development. Are you confident something will materialize?
Well, you've got to be careful about drugs that are treatment versus vaccine. We'll get an answer with drugs much more quickly than we get an answer with a vaccine. So the answer to containing this outbreak now over the next several months to a year is not going to be a vaccine. What the answer will be, and hopefully you'll be successful, is standard typical public health measures: identification, isolation, contact tracing, and quarantine where appropriate.
So you still see quarantines and even travel bans as most effective in stopping the spread of coronavirus?
Well, you know, travel bans as a permanent solution don't work. What you can do is that travel bans, when selectively used, can delay the influx of cases into other countries. We have 15 cases in the United States, 13 of which are travel-related and two of which are spouses of people who traveled. I believe, and I think everyone who's looking at the results now believe, that if we had not put the travel restriction with China several weeks ago, we would have had many more cases of coronavirus in the United States. So although it's not any permanent solution, because once you have widespread disease throughout the world, travel bans don't work. It can sometimes, and I think this case is one example, be successful on a temporary basis to delay the influx of cases.
China remains the epicenter of coronavirus, so it looks like the numbers may be stabilizing. But now we're watching as South Korea scrambles to cope with the largest number of reported cases outside of China. How should we be viewing that? And do you think we'll continue to see hot spots emerge around the globe?
Well, I hope not, because, you know, whether or not we're going to be evolving into a true pandemic is going to be dependent on two things. One, the extent to which China can control the outbreak in their own country and the number of people who travel out to go to other countries. The second important factor is how well other countries that now have travel-related cases, how well they contain the outbreak in their own country. Because once you get robust, sustained person-to-person-to-person-to-person transmission, then the situation could get worse and we could evolve into a true pandemic.
As a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, are you satisfied with the attention and focus the president is giving to this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the task force, we have a White House meeting every single day, sometimes every day plus a couple of calls. And on several occasions, we've actually physically gone in and briefed the president himself in the Oval Office. So the president is clearly very much engaged in this.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, also a member of the White House's Coronavirus Task Force. Thank you for speaking with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Starting tonight, the Taliban and U.S. forces will limit their fighting in Afghanistan. The 7-day partial ceasefire comes after almost a year and a half of intense negotiations. If this agreement holds, the two sides will sign a broader pact next week. People are hoping the process leads to a lasting peace deal and the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But some people are worried about a future Afghanistan with the Taliban in power and how women would fare. The world's Shirin Jafari has more.
This is the closest that the U.S. and the Taliban have ever come to ending the war in Afghanistan. After months of on-again, off-again negotiations, there now seems to be progress. On this path to peace, there are three parts. The first one starts tonight. Michael Kugelman is with the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington.
The two sides, the Taliban and the U.S., have agreed to some type of reduction in violence, but it's unclear as to what exactly that means.
For example, does the agreement cover the entire country? Who will enforce this? And what happens if one side reneges? But if it is successful, part two begins.
Then there would be a deal concluded between the U.S. and the Taliban on a troop withdrawal.
Part three, as the U.S. starts to withdraw its troops, the Taliban will sit down with representatives of the Afghan government to negotiate a peace deal. Just a few hours after the announcement of the agreement today, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani addressed the nation in a televised speech. Dear compatriots, he began, the next steps in the peace process will depend on the outcome of this week. Afghan forces will be monitoring the situation, he said. But there are already complications. This week, the Afghan Election Commission finally announced the winner of the presidential election. It was held 5 months ago. Ashraf Ghani is the winner, the commission said. But Abdullah, Ghani's main rival, hasn't accepted the results, and he said he's launching a parallel government of his own. Here's Marco Kugelman again.
So essentially, you're having a new political crisis come into place at the very moment when you need all of the different political stakeholders in Afghanistan needing to come together, form some type of united or common front to be able to chart some type of strategy toward peace.
Afghans have expressed mixed reactions to a possible deal between the U.S. and the Taliban. Women in particular have raised concerns about any deal that includes the Taliban.
Salam, Salah jan. Khubi?
Salam. One of them is Saleha Soada, a 30-year-old journalist and a human rights advocate in the capital, Kabul. Saleha says that the Taliban is just looking for a way to get into power, and that once it does, it will enact laws that treat women as second-class citizens. That's what it did when it was in power in the 1990s. She says so far she hasn't heard anything from the Taliban to make her think otherwise. And she blames the U.S. She says when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, one of its justifications was to improve the lives of Afghan women. But now, when advocates ask about women's rights in the peace negotiations, the Americans say that's something that the Afghans have to decide for themselves. Last year, I asked the Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen how the group thinks about the rights of women in Afghan society. This is what he said.
Actually, we are committed to women's rights, education and work. But of course, as Muslim women, they are to have all these rights within the Afghan and Islamic values.
He says women will have rights, but only under Islamic values. It's this caveat that worries Saleha, because the Taliban has a strict interpretation of Islam. In the past, the group banned education for girls. Women could only be in public if they had a male family member with them. But some Afghan women believe that despite these concerns, the Taliban has to be included in the peace process. Maryam Bardak used to work for the country's National Security Council. She says that a dialogue with the Taliban is crucial to ending the war in Afghanistan.
The Taliban are not the Taliban of the 1990s.
Bardak points out that yesterday, a major Taliban leader published an opinion piece in the New York Times.
All we have understood that these Afghan Taliban are men with turbans and gun and they don't know how to communicate. This article is quite clear that these are men who want to sit down and want to negotiate.
In fact, she thinks negotiations with the Taliban should have started a long time ago.
Many people are actually benefiting from war. They're receiving finances, contracts, etc. Then nobody really engaged in peace engagements.
Now there is an opening, she says, and all sides should give it a chance. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Up next, Russia's already messing with this year's election. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Call it deja vu, call it Groundhog Day, but here we are. Russia is meddling again. U.S. intelligence officials have told lawmakers that Russia is using influence campaigns to support Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. Alina Polyakova is head of the Center for European Policy Analysis, which means she's been tracking this precisely since the last presidential election.
I see it as much worse than 2016, actually. In 2016, the Russians were really testing the ground. Their information operations they carried out on social media platforms reached a significant number of people, but they were relatively sloppy. And I think what we're seeing now, which is very troubling, is that the Russians have learned how to obfuscate and get around ways of being detected.
Yes, specifically, what are they doing? From your research, what have you learned about some of the tactics that Russia is now using to interfere in elections? Like, what's changed since 2016?
I think the main thing that's changed has been that they've now gone to a sort of proxy warfare, if you will. And what I mean by that is, for example, in a large disinformation campaign in Africa, they established relationships with local actors on the ground who then carried out various information operations on the Russians' behalf. To us, on the research side, that just looks like, you know, normal domestic conversation. And we know that they're trying to do the exact same thing in the United States, meaning trying to get actual Americans to spread their disinformation content versus doing it themselves. Then we have very limited ways of knowing whether these are real authentic accounts or Russian accounts, especially if they're setting up servers in the United States versus in Russia. And so I think we are now operating almost blind in terms of being able to tell what the Russians are actually doing.
Yeah, something you just mentioned there, too, was intriguing. Those reports that the Russians have moved servers to the U.S., so IP addresses won't be identified as Russians. I mean, how real is that? What do you know?
Again, without having access to classified information, we have very little knowledge of how they're obfuscating their behavior. What I can say is that from some of their activities in other places, in Ukraine, for example, has been a test lab for Russian influence operations, cyber attacks, disinformation campaigns for decades. And what we know is that what happens in these countries doesn't stay in these countries. Eventually, it all comes to us. And I want to make it very clear, it's not just the Russians. We also know that the Chinese are moving into the information space, the Iranians, North Korea, many others, and they're copying the Russian playbook.
The UK and the US confirmed yesterday that Russia conducted a huge cyber attack on the Republic of Georgia last year. What happened there?
The attack in Georgia, which was just now attributed to the Russians, took down television stations, many websites, government websites, really targeted the media. And we've seen attacks like this before. It's not an isolated incident. And Russia has consistently amplified and reinvested in its ability to carry out these kinds of attacks. And certainly, I would not be surprised to see something similar happening in the United States very soon.
Alina, Russian officials have denied everything, the Georgia cyber attack, the 2016 election meddling here in the States, as well as these new charges of meddling in the 2020 election. Russian officials say the U.S. is paranoid. Is that reaction surprising to you?
No, it's not surprising at all. Of course, the Russian official line has always been deny, deny, deny. But that doesn't mean that we should take them at their word, of course. Our intelligence agencies have proven without a doubt that the Russians have been consistently involved in influence operations in Georgia, in Ukraine, and certainly here in the United States. And independent researchers have also verified that.
Another reaction from Russia to these charges comes from Russia's representative to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, who tweeted, "Why would we want this president reelected? Relations at lowest point, dozens of diplomats expelled, nonstop sanctions. Does he have a point here? Why would Russia want to support a Trump reelection?"
So there's no question that the Russians want to see a United States that is polarized, politically divided. This serves the Russian interest. And they see President Trump as a divisive figure, and it's in their interest to ensure the U.S. remains divided. I would say that they probably also see other presidential candidates as divisive figures, such as Bernie Sanders. So for the Russians, this is really about their own interests. It's about disruption. And they see supporting President Trump as a way to do so.
Alina Polyakova with the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you for your thoughts. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You've probably never given much thought to the carbon footprint of your martini, but a distillery in Scotland has. Arbeaky Distillery has created a climate-positive gin out of green peas. The company says growing the peas and producing the gin actually reduces carbon emissions. Ian Stirling is the founder of Arbeaky Distillery in Arbroath, Scotland.
Our family have been farming for over 400 years, so we have a background in growing just about everything over those centuries. And also our head distiller, Kirsty, creating this gin was part of her PhD. So she was working with the local university, Abertay University, and the specialist there, the food and drink specialist. And also it was a project about legumes and specifically peas and how you could create carbon positive beers and spirits.
Yeah, and when you say legume, a pea is a legume, and that's good for the soil when you plant these types of vegetables.
It is indeed. Yeah, because as farmers, probably the biggest cost in our business, or certainly one of the biggest costs, is putting on artificial fertilizer, so nitrogen back into the soil after we've cultivated crops. But peas naturally put them back in the ground. So as farmers, we're getting free nitrogen as well as obviously harvesting a crop that we're then using both to make gin and also you get pea protein as well.
So why is sustainability important to you and your distillery, Ian?
We inherited a farming business from our parents and from our family. And my brothers and I are custodians of the land that we farm just now. And, you know, actually making that environment continue to thrive is really, really important to us. Whether that's the soils, whether that's using regenerative farming practices. So we'll take less yields these days in terms of some of the crops, just to make sure that we're looking after the land and the environment we live in. You know, I think lots of people are doing their little bit. We're doing our little bit at Arbiki.
So the production of this gin is sustainable, but there would be carbon costs if it was going to get shipped to, say, the United States, right?
Of course, there's always carbon costs, but ultimately our goal is to be one of the most sustainable distilleries in the world. Everyone still has to travel. Everyone still has to ship goods around the world. But otherwise, we'll do as best as we can to offset that and more than offset that, because if we use more and more peas, we're going to, you know, create our own negative space of carbon. And that can only be a good thing in the world.
And can I ask you how your Arbiki pea gin works in a martini? Do the peas add a little sweetness so you can almost go vermouth free?
I had my first martini on Wednesday night at a little celebration we had with our scientific partners, and it was amazingly good. We actually grow our own juniper, we grow our own lemongrass, and we grow our own kaffir lime leaves. And with the lime leaves and with the lemongrass, it's got amazing botanical flavor, and it was amazingly good.
Ian Stirling, the founder of Arbiki Distillery in Arbroath, Scotland, thank you for being with us. Great to talk.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. It's carnival time in Rio. All those glittery, colorful parade floats, they tell a story.
The floats act like moving theater sets, with dancers on top acting out scenes from Brazilian history or literature.
One of those stories?
It's already creating huge controversy.
And no, it's not the Tinder float. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. On Thursday, rival political leaders in South Sudan announced they would agree to share power and form a unity government by tomorrow. It could spell the end to a six-year civil war that has devastated the country. Previous attempts at peace have failed, but people are hoping that this time will be different. The World's Halima Gikandi has a story.
The conflict between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar has dragged South Sudan into a years-long civil war. But it wasn't always that way. 9 years ago, the two were standing side by side as president and vice president. They were celebrating something that doesn't happen every day, the birth of a new nation.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, excellencies, President Kiir, people of South Sudan, congratulations!
That's former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, speaking at the official ceremony to celebrate South Sudan's new independence from Sudan. The date was July 9, 2011, and Ambassador Rice was part of a special delegation sent by President Barack Obama. Ambassador Donald Steinberg was also there. He was serving as the Deputy Administrator of USAID, a U.S. agency for international development.
This was the culmination of literally decades of work to try to bring autonomy and self-determination to the people of southern Sudan.
Steinberg remembers that day vividly because it was too hot to forget.
We were fighting over the shade that was there, The new South Sudanese army stood in front of us, and as it got hotter and hotter, soldiers would faint, and people would pick them up and take them to the back and then bring up a new soldier to take his place.
Manasa Mathiang remembers that day, too. He's a South Sudanese artist who was standing in the crowd. He says people weren't collapsing because it was too hot. They were collapsing because they were too excited.
We felt that now finally we feel like we have a country where we belong.
But that new country where people now belonged quickly split apart. In 2013, just 2 years after independence, President Salva Kiir fired Vice President Riek Machar. Soon, the country erupted into a bloody civil war. Alan Boswell is a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group.
Those leaders, as soon as they got independence, they basically a power struggle over who would lead the country of South Sudan and really who would capture this oil revenue.
South Sudan's oil reserves are key to its economy.
There was, you know, a sort of scramble, a king of the hill scramble to see who would get on top and sort of get that oil revenue. And everyone kind of got sucked into this.
The civil war has displaced more than 1 million people in the country, and more than 2 million other citizens have fled to neighboring countries. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. The international community has tried to end the war multiple times, but the last attempt at peace ended with rebel leader Riek Machar fleeing the country by foot. That's when Manasa Mathiang, the South Sudanese artist, decided to become an activist. He formed the youth movement Anataban, which in Arabic means "we are tired."
Anataban by itself, the name itself, is a protest of the unnecessary suffering that the citizens of South Sudan had been subjected to.
The United States, which has helped steer the country into independence, has grown more and more frustrated. Over the past decade, the U.S. has donated billions of dollars in humanitarian aid. The analyst Alan Boswell is in South Sudan, and he says it's hard to see where the money has gone.
I was in a town called Raja, which, you know, it looks like 90% of the town has basically been emptied. Most of the town is destroyed. There's just brick homes with no roofs. You know, it looks post-apocalyptic.
Last year, the U.S. said it may have to reevaluate the relationship with South Sudan if political elites can't get their act together. And in recent months, the U.S. Treasury Department has announced back-to-back sanctions on South Sudanese officials who they've called peace process spoilers. Regional African leaders have been brokering meetings between opposing sides, and even the Vatican has gotten involved. Last year, Pope Francis kissed the feet of the president and the rebel leader, pleading for them to make peace. This week, the two leaders had a breakthrough and agreed to share power. Nyagatut Poor is a South Sudanese researcher at Human Rights Watch. She says that the leaders agreeing to share power is only the beginning. Human rights needs to be at the center of the peace process.
There are children who are, you know, 5 years old now, and the only thing they know is the corners of a tent in a UN base and nothing outside that. So the incoming unity government has a lot it should address.
Both sides have been accused of committing potential war crimes, including the kidnapping and mass rape of women and girls.
Despite the fact that there's an over-focus on power sharing in the peace agreements, there are numerous human rights issues that need to be addressed, one of which is, you know, ensuring abducted women and girls are released from armed groups.
The same day that these two leaders agreed to share power, the United Nations released a report showing that both sides were starving the population and embezzling funds meant for humanitarian relief. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Iranian voters went to the polls today to elect a new parliament, or majlis. Many moderates were blocked from running by election authorities. Meanwhile, Iran has been officially blacklisted by an international body. The Financial Action Task Force decided Iran is failing to comply with anti-terrorism financing guidelines. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Barbara, let's start with that news from the Financial Task Force in Paris. How significant is it, and what does it actually mean for Iran?
Well, it is significant, although the Iranian economy has been so isolated primarily by U.S. sanctions that the impact may not be that great. there had been hope for several years that Iran would enact anti-terrorism legislation, anti-money laundering legislation. And it actually passed through the parliament a couple of times, but then was blocked by something called the Guardian Council, which also figures in the elections. It has enormous powers to block legislation, to vet candidates. So it didn't go through in time to meet a deadline. And after 3 years of having Iran on a so-called gray list, they are back on the blacklist that they were on before 2016.
Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure from the Trump administration to put Iran on this blacklist as part of the so-called maximum pressure campaign that we've been seeing against Iran. This is an effort to make Iran pay and hurt as much as possible, allegedly to get Iran to return to the negotiating table for new negotiations. But frankly, lately, it has looked mostly just like punishment without any particular strategy or goal in mind.
Did the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani kind of reprise the concern of Iran's proxy battles outside Iran, led by Soleimani?
Well, you know, I think one of the arguments by those who did not want to put in place these financial transparency laws is that it would be used as a way to prevent Iran from continuing to support these various proxy movements. I'm not sure if that's true. I think most of this kind of assistance takes place in cash. It doesn't go through banks. But there has been a general hardening of anti-Western sentiment in Iran since the U.S. assassinated Soleimani. And the thought that Iran would do the West a favor by approving these measures, I think that became less and less popular.
My impression has been that much of the rest of the world has been trying to distance itself from the U.S.'s maximum pressure campaign. How significant is it that the international community is getting together behind these measures against Iran?
Well, again, you know, I think Europeans in particular fought this for a long time, but they're in a difficult situation. How much time can you give Iran to pass these measures? Plus, you know, the Iranians have been moving out of the Iran nuclear deal. They're no longer in full compliance with it, and I think there's frustration.
Meanwhile, Iranians were out voting in parliamentary elections today. What have you heard about turnout?
It looks like it's pretty low, which is what everybody expected. I mean, the Guardian Council, again, disqualified many of the so-called reformist candidates, including many of the incumbent members of parliament. The mood in Iran is extremely hopeless and depressed, and the usual exhortations that would get people out to the polls don't seem to be working.
So what will these elections actually change in Iran?
Well, the parliament is not exactly the most important body in Iran, but it does have some influence. And I think everyone sees this as a kind of run-up to a complete takeover of all of the elected institutions by conservative forces in the country. You get a sense that Iran is really hunkering down under pressure from the United States. And any move toward liberalization, toward reform, is just not going to happen.
That's Barbara Slavin at the Atlantic Council. Always good to chat, Barbara. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Iranian writer Nazila Fati raised her kids in the U.S. and realized they were hearing a lot of negative messages about their country. So eventually she took things into her own hands by writing two new children's books celebrating Persian history and culture. Nazila Fati tells me they were very personal projects.
My kids, who are teenagers now, were having some identity crisis when they were much younger. My son changed his name to Jack when he was 8 years old. And I felt that there was something that I'd done wrong, that I have messed up things for them. Their identity crisis was partly because they were hearing so many negative things about Iran. In 2012-2013, we drove to school every morning, and my kids were hearing what was on the news about Iran. This was a time that Iran and the U.S. were almost in full confrontation over Iran's nuclear program. And they started feeling that Iran was a country that they didn't want to have anything to do with. They wanted to distance themselves, and this was painful for me. So I started telling them stories about Iran, Iranian figures who had contributed to human civilization, who had done something great, basically in an effort to remind them there were many positive things about their culture.
And you and your family, you were living in the States when all this kind of occurred to you. What did you think you had done wrong as a parent?
Well, as a parent, I felt that I failed to introduce the Persian culture to my kids in a proper way. I wanted them to feel what Iran had been once upon a time, to feel what Iranian figures had contributed to science, to politics, to mathematics. And so I started telling them stories about prominent figures like Avicenna, like Cyrus, like Darius, and what they had done.
Right. So the first book you wrote is about Cyrus, the founder of the Persian Empire, and then this book about Avicenna, the father of modern medicine. Why did you choose these particular stories to tell?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can talk to Iranians without mentioning Cyrus.
Right.
To Iranians, Cyrus is what Moses is to the Jews. Basically, to Iranians, their liberator, the founder of their civilization, the man who made them proud. So definitely Cyrus was going to be among the first books that I wrote. But Avicenna was even more than a physician, more than a doctor. He was also a philosopher.
There's an interesting little passage that I'm just going to read from Avicenna in your book. Avicenna, known as Ibn Sina or Abu Ali Sina in the Middle East, studied and worked so hard that he became the best doctor in the city of Bukhara when he was just a teenager. So when Bukhara's ruler fell ill and no doctor in town could treat him, they sent for Avicenna. "Your Majesty," said a 15-year-old Avicenna confidently, "you are suffering from lead poisoning." He gave the ruler medicine, and within days he recovered. So I read those pages because they do telegraph a sense of pride for this man. Were you consciously telling these stories with this kind of intent?
Definitely. I came across a lot of Iranian kids who were my children's friends. And they were named like Avicenna, Cyrus, Darius. And I used to ask them, "Do you know what your name means?" I knew those were very meaningful names for their parents when they had chosen them. But a lot of these kids didn't know anything about the people they were named after. So, I mean, that was my intention. I want to write stories that would tell kids who are growing up here, very far away from their motherland, that everything is not dark and negative about Iran.
How old are your kids now, and what do they think of the books?
My kids are 14 and 15 and a half. They've read the books many times as I was writing them. They were my editors.
Huh.
And, you know, they feel much more confident about who they are now.
Well, I'm imagining all of your books on the shelves of the kids section of the library. For non-Iranian kids, what kind of impact do you want these stories to have?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. You know, stories convey values, beliefs, attitudes. And I don't want these stories just to be for Iranian kids. I think we live at a time that we are exposed to a lot of negative narrative about immigrants of certain background. And so I think the need for children to read global stories more than ever, not just about Iran, about other cultures as well. So I really hope that American kids would read this books, just so that we will have a better understanding of different cultures.
Nazila Fati, author of the children's books My Name is Cyrus and Avicenna, the Father of Modern Medicine. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Children's literature may have changed over the years, but kids themselves, nah, they're basically still the same. How do we know? Look at the British Library's new children's literature website. One of the gems now online there is a manners book for children dating back to 1480. It's written in Middle English, and if you can make your way around the extra E's and I's and V's, you get this instruction. Here goes. Pica nota thina eris, nothar thy nostrilis, which translates to don't pick your ears or your nostrils. How about this one? Bulle not as a bene, vera in thy throta. Don't burp as if you have a bean in your throat. Good advice for you aspiring little lords and ladies out there. The sounds of carnival, which begins this weekend in Brazil. Millions of people will celebrate in the streets. In Rio de Janeiro, the samba schools that fuel these street parties will face off in competitions, thousands of spectators cheering them on. If you're a local, you know that each of the floats in those parades tells a story. Here's Catherine Osborne in Rio with more.
The staging grounds for Rio's carnival floats take up an entire city block in an industrial port zone. The block is ringed by four-story garages. The garages open into a central plaza where supply trucks and motorcycles whiz by and costumed dancers scurry around. Each garage serves as a samba school workshop where the floats are being built. Music filters out of these workshops, with workers sometimes banging along with the beat. Inside one of these workshops, architect Silvio Cielo puts the finishing touches on the first of 8 floats. Cielo started his career building shopping malls, then transitioned to film sets. Now, he's one of the more than 3,000 people who work year-round on Carnival.
Pai de santo que nasceu na Bahia e que descobriu lá.
Cielo explains that this year, his school's parade tells the story of a historical Afro-Brazilian religious leader who was active in the 1930s through 60s.
Na infância dele a ter visões.
The first float represents the divine visions this leader, Joãozinho da Gomeia, had as a young man. It looks like a 2-deck barge, with sides made of African masks and giant lanterns. Multicolored fishing nets and handmade lace drapes hang from the top deck. Rio Samba schools publicize the story of their parade each year, so the people watching can understand what each one means. The floats act like moving theater sets, with dancers on top acting out scenes from Brazilian history or literature. Together, the dancers sing the samba ballad that narrates their story. One of the parade's judges is art historian Felipe Ferreira. He says the floats are evaluated more by the stories they tell than by their visual beauty. Sometimes the best art is what shocks you and makes you pay attention, Ferreira says. One float that's generating buzz is a life-size model of a poor neighborhood. The float celebrates the neighborhood's positive qualities by depicting children playing and musicians performing. Another float depicts Jesus as gay, an image likely to upset some in Brazil's conservative government. It's already creating huge controversy, he says. As final preparations are made, the floats receive spray paint touch-ups. Dancers test the weight capacity of the floats with full-scale rehearsals. Silvio Cielo says all of the floats are built beginning with the same basic structure. A motorized platform with a driver in the front and a large generator in the back, which powers the lights and moving parts.
Madeira, isopor, fibra, forração.
The structures are built up from that platform, first with iron and then with wood siding. Next come styrofoam decorations, paint, lighting, and any other special effects. Cielo says the floats typically carry 4 to 6 tons of weight and as many as 100 dancers. While some samba schools, like Cielo's, aim to project dignity and grandeur, others aim to make people laugh. That's the case of São Clemente. The school is conducting an electricity test when I walk into its garage. Generators are humming, and yellow lights are flashing in all directions. Their parade is dedicated to scams that have fooled gullible Brazilians over the years, explains Thiago Almeida, the garage supervisor. One float tells the story of a man who made money claiming to sell Brazilians property on the moon. Another part of the parade depicts people who post unrealistic photos on the dating app Tinder. And one float will feature a famous comedian known for his impressions of Brazilian politicians. It's rumored that for the big reveal on Monday night, he will dress as Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro promised during his campaign to end corruption in the country, a pledge some have found laughable. Jorge Silveira designed this parade. He says laughter can help people accept unflattering truths about themselves, and he hopes change their behavior. It's these social critiques and tributes in Rio's carnival parades that make them more than just a party. In between all of the sequins and electrical rigging, onlookers can glimpse new insights into Brazilian history and their own identities. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
It's not carnival, but in the Algerian capital of Algiers for the past year, something like a political party breaks out in the streets every Friday. Today was Friday number 53, and the peaceful protesters were out again. This pro-democracy movement in Algeria, or Hirak as it's known, pushed out the longtime ruler of the country last year. But protesters say they still see too many old-school players in politics, and they're not happy. Nor is this guy.
Sofiane Saïdi, chanteur franco-algérien.
Sofiane Saïdi, French-Algerian singer. He lives in France and is paying close attention to what's happening in his native Algeria.
Là, ce qui se passe, en tout cas, c'est la meilleure preuve qu'on peut arriver avec des choses pacifistes comme ils le font.
What's happening there is proof, he says, that change can happen in a peaceful way.
Moi, j'ai fait en 88, octobre 88, ça, je l'ai vécu.
In 1988, Saïdi says, I was still living in Algeria and protested. This was during a previous regime that the youth opposed. We were not as mature as these kids are today, he says, and we are very proud of what the young Algerians are doing.
Juste qu'il y ait un gouvernement légitime.
We're all just waiting for a legitimate government that represents the diversity of the Algerian people. Sofiane Saïdi speaks out in favor of change, but he does not write political songs. He says the fact that his band Mazalda sings in Arabic, Berber, and French shows a stand with democracy. And that's The World on this Friday. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. For me and the rest of the team, have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.